most well-known of the Tfilos of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It also happens to actually be, there is a legend that is associated with this prayer. So I want to explore a little bit of the history and questions of the authorship of this prayer, and there's also, I think, some very good theological insights that come with it as well. So on the first page, on page 2, I just copied and pasted the Tfilah translation from Sfaria. So we're not so much here. We could go through a lot of allusions or a lot of poetic aspects. A lot of the poetic aspects were discussed in an article by Professor Reuben Kimmelman, which this article I'm going to quote from. But he goes very much into depth about the poetry of the prayer and some of the allusions to Midrashim and the biblical allusions and the like. So we have to begin discussing Masechta Tokef by discussing the famous story that's originally brought in the Or Zarur, Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna. And he found a copy of a letter from Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn, who's a very significant Rishon of that time. So let's tell the story, and I'm going to read it in English just for the sake of efficiency. It's kind of hard to read here, but what? No, not as far as I know, and so I have a packet from Rabbi J.J. Schachter where he has some of these cards. So I don't know where he got this translation from, but that's where I saw the translation. So he says this is a story of what happened to her unknown of Mainz. Okay, Mainz was one of the three central. If you have Tina, Queens, and Brooklyn are like three centers, nearby centers of Judaism. I mean, there's obviously more, but just some examples. So Mainz was one of the three, one of these three centers: Mainz, Speyer, and Worms. Okay, so he was from Mainz. He was one of the greatest men of his generation, and rich, and of a good family, and handsome, and well formed. Okay, sounds a little bit almost like Eov. There's some Eov references in. And Unasan and Tokef, but he was somebody who had everything going for him. The lords and the archbishop began to demand that he convert to their religion. So he had a relationship with his archbishop, and they wanted him to convert to Christianity, as would often happen during this time period. It came to pass, after they had spoken to him day after day, and he would not listen. On bottom page 3. I'm reading the Or Zarur. You read the whole thing on Rosh Hashanah. Okay, we can reference it, but anyway, they would try to convert him. He wouldn't listen, though the archbishop himself was urging him. That one day he said to them, "I wish to take counsel to think about this matter for another 3 days." Okay, so at some point he said, "You know, I'm going to think about it. I'll get back to you." He said this to put them up. So he tried. So he said, "You know, he thought maybe if I give them." But tell them I'll come back in some time, then maybe they'll stop pestering me for a little while. It came to pass that the moment he left the presence of the archbishop, he took it to his heart that he allowed a word of doubt to have his lips, as though he needs to take counsel and thought to deny the living God. Okay, so, you know, already by the mere suggestion that he would think about converting to Christianity, even though he didn't mean it, so he already had a little bit of, he was upset about that. So he went home, and he would neither eat nor drink, and fell sick, and all his near ones and loved ones came to console him, but he refused to be consoled. For he said, "I shall go down to the grave mourning because of what I have said." And he wept and was sad at heart. So he really took this very hard. It came to pass on the third day, while he was in pain and anxiety, that the archbishop sent after him. Okay, so they certainly did not forget about him. They kept coming back to him. And he said, "I shall not go." And his foe continued to send many and even more distinguished lords. But Amnon still refused to go to the archbishop. Then the archbishop said, "Bring Amnon against his will immediately." Okay, so you get a crew, they bring him, so they hurried and brought him. He said to him, "What is this, Amnon? Why have you not come to me? Why have you not come to reply to me and to do my desire at the end of time you've set for yourself in which you take counsel? Why didn't you come to me when you said you would?" And Amnon answered and said, I shall pronounce my own sentence. So if the tongue that spoke and lied to you could be cut out. Probably two things that are really bothering him. Number one, you know, the tongue that said that I will think about it, that he himself thought was heretical. And, you know, and he's suggesting to the archbishop, well, I also lied to you, so let my tongue be cut out. For Rabbi Amnon wished to sanctify God because he had thus spoken. So then the archbishop answered and said, no, the tongue I shall not cut out, for it spoke very well. Okay, of course, the archbishop was happy that he said he was going to come. But the feet that did not come to me at the time that he said, I shall lop off, and the rest of the body I shall punish. So he said, well, since your feet made a mistake and not coming to me, I'm going to chop those off. Then the oppressor commanded, and they lopped off the fingers of Rav Amnon's hands and his feet. At every finger they asked him, will you convert Amnon? He said, no. Okay, it's very brutal. And it came to pass, when they had finished lopping off his fingers, that the wicked man ordered Rav Amnon to be laid on a shield with all his fingers at his side, and he sent him home. He was ready to call Rabbi Amnon, for he had faith in the living God and lovingly suffered severe affliction simply because of one word he had spoken. Okay, so Amnon and Muna. After these events, the days of Allah approach and Rosh Hashanah arrived. Rabbi Amnon asked his relatives to bear him to the house of prayer just as he was and to lay him down near the reader. They did so, and it came to pass when the reader came to recite Kiddusha, Rabbi Amnon said, hold, and I shall sanctify the great name of God. And he cried in a loud voice, and thus may the sanctification is sent to you, v'lechein l'chata l'chidusha. That is to say that I've sanctified your name for the sake of your kingship and unity, right, by Kiddush Hashem, by not converting. And afterward he said, and we shall express the powerful sanctity of this day. It said, it is true that you are the judge and arbiter, etc. So he said it is unisan tokev. And when he ended, his own end came and he vanished from the earth before the eye of all, for God had taken him. Okay, so he died right then and there. 3 days after Rav Amnon had been called to the academy on high, he appeared to Rabbi Kolomonos ben Rabbi Meshulam. The Kolomonos family was a distinguished Ashkenaz family. So he came to him in a dream of night and taught him the liturgical poem beginning, and we shall express the power and sanctity of the day. He taught him Unisan Tokif. He ordered him to send it all to the diaspora to be his testimony and remembrance. Rabbi Kolomonos did so. So this is all brought in the Orzarua. Orzarua is Ruka Falacha, but he brings this whole legend here. Orzarua lived about, I think, what would be 100 years after the story was said to have taken place. Okay, so this is a story, if you look in art scroll, this is a story that's told. This is the general attribution. We generally assume that was Rabbi Amnon who composed this prayer and said it from the heart, and that is a legend. The problem with this authorship is that they eventually found manuscripts of Unisan Tokev in the Cairo Geniza, and the manuscript would be dated before the 11th century when the story was said to have taken place. So it does not seem that it was possible that Rabbi Amnon wrote it.
That was considered also the miracle, that Unisan Tokev had been accepted throughout the diaspora.
Right, sure. So, okay, so now I burst your bubble a little bit, and and maybe not as miraculous as it sounds. We'll have to explore why it might be that this is a tribute to Rabbi Amnon, and if there's a message in that. So it's generally assumed that so now it's assumed by many scholars, including Professor Pinchas Goldschmidt, I think, is the one who edited the Machzor in the 70s. He's the one who sort of brought this to light. So it's thought that perhaps it was the poet Yanai. We say many of Yanai's poems on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I think maybe even on Tisha B'Av. He was a teacher of Rav Elazar Kalir, who composed a lot of piyutim, we say, on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Tisha B'Av. But it's assumed. So many people assume that it's Yanai. So I'm going to come back to perhaps the potential proof that it's possible that Yanai or one of his contemporaries would have written it. But first, we need to explore one of the key lines of this. Tshuva tefillah tzedakah ma'avir nisra'ah ha'gzeira. Okay, that's a big mantra of the time. We do tshuva, we do tefillah, we do tzedakah, so that will avert the evil decree. Okay, everybody familiar? Okay. So, where does this idea of true Tfilat Tzedakah averting the old creed to come from? Did it come from this period directly? So, it originally comes from the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah. I think it's a Medrash that also brings it. Rav Rosh Hashanah says, "I'm a Rabbi Yitzchak. Arba dvarim mekarin zar dino shel adam elu hein staka tzaka shinui Hashem v'shinui ma'aseh." Okay, so our piyut has how many things ever the evil decree?
Three.
How many does the Gemara have?
Four.
Okay, so that's going to be a slight problem.
Shinui Hashem. It's not something that changing the names when they get sick.
Okay, well, so what was that?
A normal practice. Change your name every year,
unless you're Shonas. Okay, right. So, I mean,
it's not practical.
Look, I don't. I guess you know, without the context of the Gemara in front of me, so I don't know if it's Stavka saying that you have to do these things on Rosh Hashanah, but your point is well taken, and maybe that's one reason why Shinui Hashem doesn't appear in the pew, because it's not practical. So first of all, so Stavka, what's Zaka? What does Zaka correspond to in the pew? Davening, okay, and what's Shinui Maisa correspond to? Shinui Maisa, changing one's deed, so that would be associated with Tshuva, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so it seems like, so some of these certainly line up, but what's different about this than our Piyut, besides the fact that Shinui Hashem is there? The sequence is different, so it's reverse order, so we have Tshuva Tefillah Tzedakah, and the Gemara said Tzedakah Tzedakah Shinui Maisa. So it's the total opposite. Okay, and Gemara brings the proofs. I'm not entirely integral for the time being. Okay, so let's start with the Shinui Shem issue. So the Marsha addresses the Shinui Shem issue. This is in source 3. So I'll just say outside. So there are two points that he makes here. Number one. Perhaps the pipe. So he addresses the already. Marsha is living 16th, 17th century. Don't remember, but long after Unsan Tokev is accepted. Okay, so he refers directly to the piyut and addressing this Gemara. So he says that. Well, perhaps he says two things really. Number one, perhaps the Paitan, the poet, perhaps he assumed that Shinui Hashem and is part of tshuva. Now, what does it mean to do tshuva? Doing tshuva again is not just it's not necessarily what we call someone a baal tshuva. So it's not tshuva is not just becoming entirely observant, but changing something about us that's completely problematic. And when we do tshuva, in some ways we become a new person. We become a new person. People see the change in us, so it's sort of like as if we become a new person. So perhaps the Marsha says that's what Shinui Hashem, there might be something to be said for changing one's name, but also changing one's name and Shinui Shem and Shinui Maisen might really be similar things. That through changing our deeds, we also sort of change the name and in other words, the reputation we have. Okay, when we talk about having a shame tov, having a good reputation, so maybe that's what's there. The other thing that the Marsha addresses, which might in some ways I guess answer Herb's question, is that where do we get Shinui Hashem from? Comes from Avram and Sarah. Okay, and they want to have children. So changing one's name might be something about luck. Okay, which so changing name because we want to change the luck of somebody who's ill. Okay, so if we want to talk about being a Gzardin, talk about averting a decree, so this might not necessarily be about Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur per se, but it might be that in general, if you want a change in the situation, so maybe Shinui Hashem will change your luck a little bit. But it has nothing to do with sin. What?
It's not when someone's sick, you don't change them, then you add on
another. Right, add on. Right, okay, fine. But. Yeah.
They change, they don't call them by that name anymore.
Oh, okay.
When you call them up to the Torah, you use the name.
So an example of that actually would be.
That name anymore.
example of that would actually be Rabbi Steinsaltz. Rabbi Steinsaltz was originally Rabbi. I think Steinsaltz is his original name, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe told him to change it to Evan Yisrael.
But it might be
But I think there was a similar idea that there was, But anyway, Shinui Hashem doesn't necessarily have anything to do with sin. The other three things, so maybe I want to do stuck. You know, if I sin, so maybe I want to get stuck on. I want to do tshuva. Maybe I want to daven. So that has something to do with sin, perhaps. But changing our name is more about luck. So that's how the Marsha deals with that discrepancy. Meanwhile, there's just one thing, we'll come back to this, but one thing just to point out that's going to be relevant in a little while is that it says, Arba Dvar Mekar In Gzardi. It says that there are four things that tear up the decree, right, totally annulled, versus RP, it says Ma'avirin Razera. So Ma'avir doesn't necessarily mean that it's totally nullified, it's just kind of, it's passed over for a little bit. So I'll have to come back to that in a little bit, but I just want to plant that seed in your head. So this idea, Tshuva Tefillat Tzedakah, also comes up in the Yerushalmi. So in source 5, Yerushalmi says, Amar Rab Lazar, Shlosha Dvarim Mevatlin Et Agzera Kasha. Okay, so Mevatlin and Makarin have similar connotations that it's totally wiped out. Ve'elu Hein Tefila Utzedakah U'Tshuva. Okay, so what again here is different? The sequence. Okay, so why might that be? So the Gemara, the Rishami quotes a pasuk, but I gave it in source 4. I gave you the actual pasuk, and it's good to sort of see it in its order. It says, "Ve'kanu ami asher nikrash mi aleihem." When my people who bear my name humble themselves, feast palulu, and they pray, ve'vakshu panai, and they seek my favor, ve'shuvu midarehem. And they return from the evil ways. So when they turn away from the evil ways, so I will hear in my heavenly abode and forgive their sins and heal their hand. So the Gemara explains that is tefillah. Vivakshu panai is tzedaka. Right. Because that's based on the pasuk of Ani Betzedek Echze Panacha, I'll see your face through justice. Okay, so Tzedaka comes next in the verse, and then Veshuva Midarcheihem Haraim is Tshuva. So the Yerushalmi has a different order of this based on the pasuk. It's Tefillah Tzedaka U'Tshuva. The order is different. So why might have Yanai, or whoever wrote the piyut, changed it? So, one reason this was suggested, I saw this in Professor Kimmelman, I don't know if somebody else suggested it before him, so one reason is because the order in Sefer Yonah, in terms of what the people of Ninde did, actually corresponds with the piyut. So it says, the people in Ninde believed in God, they proclaimed a fast, okay, so that would be tshuva, the matter reached the king. Okay, so that's the tshuva, the sackcloth and the fasting by his ache. And then they called out. So then they cried out, so that's the tefillah. And then in the last pasuk chet, it says, they turn back from the evil ways and from the injustice of which he is guilty. So injustice, so Hamas often refers to violence, which is stealing. So the tzedakah that they did, it's not the tzedakah in terms of charity, but the tzedakah in terms of giving back the money to people who rightfully belong to. So the piyut has something to rely on, perhaps from Divrei Hayamim, but from Sefer Yonah, and doing the order
is fasted part of it?
What?
It's like
Yom Kippur.
Correct, so.
Is that part of what?
That's part of Tshuva. Tshuva.
Not Tfila?
It's Tshuva. Tshuva. Right, we're not such a tzaddikim anymore, but people who are on Shem Ha'isa, they used to fast when they wanted to do Tshuva.
I have a question.
Yom Kashan and Stucca. What?
Yeah. So Stucca we don't do. Stucca means money. Because on Yom Tov we don't get Stucca. So we're saying Tefillah and Tshuva, we're doing a lot of that.
So what are you doing on Yom Tov? So then you have to do it.
Come after.
Well, two things. Number one, I guess you can pledge. You can pledge money.
It's at the end.
You can pledge money on Hashan Yom Kippur or Aseret Yemei Tshuva also give tzedakah or during Elul give tzedakah. Okay, so
I'm
talking
Rosh Hashanah.
What?
Tzedakah's at the end because you did the tshuva and the tefillah, and tzedakah you're going to accomplish when you
perhaps so
pay your bill. Man.
Okay, that's a fair point. So another suggestion from the Mante Moshe. So Mante Moshe notes that there are actually some people who thought that the order of the piyut should be changed because maybe there was an error. So but it should go according to the Yerushalmi. It should go Tefillah, Tzedakah, and Tshuva. So maybe we should change the order. So Mante Moshe Nachron says no, that's a bad idea because number one, this is exactly as Tan Nachzorim. Must be a reason to rely on it, and even the Maharil, who was one of the later Rishonim, so he didn't change it, but if he was very meticulous in what he said, so if he didn't change it, then it must be right, and he said maybe so you have somebody who goes through and thinks, oh, I'm going to fix mistakes. This is what academics do. They take texts and they try to find the mistakes and say, well, really, the text should really say this. Well, maybe the text was originally exactly as it was supposed to be, and the Python was greater. The person who originally wrote the text was greater than the person who's amending it. So that's one point he makes. But another point he makes is that the point was so he changed the order a little bit. But he says, "Esher shizeu haya kavanas amesader umiya v'olachar amachshel kvar asahu devadai tshuva kodem dilo yishem midarko hara amalo lizok od al pnei hamalach Hashem betfila." Okay, so the order, the order of the shaman might be tefila tzedakah tshuva, and that's based on the pasuk. Okay, so maybe there's a place for that. But on the other hand, what's the point of doing tefila if you haven't done your tshuva yet? You can stand there all day begging Hashem to forgive you. But if you haven't done anything to change anything, then there's nothing to daven for yet. So Mante Moshe suggests that perhaps the Python did something very intentional in changing the order.
When we do the Al Chayt, it's after Tshuva, not before.
So you're saying that's a Tshuva.
If you consider it.
Okay, but so. Yeah, yes, and then on the other hand, I would still say, so clapping al chayt is not tshuva. Clapping al chayt, so it's one step towards tshuva. What?
It's not tefillah.
Right, okay, no, fine, but I mean, so there's a place for vidui, but the real work of tshuva comes before you say the al chayt, or al chayt maybe is the start of that. Okay, so just a couple other points in terms of tshuva, tefillah, tzedakah. So I noted that both the Yerushalmi and the Babli have this idea that the Zera is entirely wiped out, and yet our version in Unas Hanatokim says Ma'avirin is for Hagzera. So why is it that it's merely passed over and not annulled? Another problem there would be that it's one thing to say to be Korea the Zera to entirely wipe up rip up a decree, but you don't, if there's a decree, so you either fulfill it, it's either upheld or it's annulled. What does it mean that we are mabir? So, Professor Kimmelman first notes that the idea of being mabir, the gzera, might refer to the famous medrash of Adam Harishon, where it says, he was created in this hour, and then he sinned in this hour, and then he was banished from God Eden, has a lashon of, there's a lashon of being mavir that when Hashem banished him, so originally he was supposed to die when he ate from the fruit, okay. But the point, but he still lived a long life. So the idea was that gzera it was averted for a little while, but not completely annulled. And that's what we have here also, that the decree might not be entirely destroyed, but we can ask Hashem to, at the very least, try to avert it and to push it off. No, and that's why. That's
a gzera.
What?
Mavir is a gzera. You have that word in the middle.
Well, so the thing is, Mavir is roha gzera, because you're not getting rid of the decree, but you're just averting the harshness of the decree.
Right.
Okay, so that's the point Professor Kimmelman makes. But I think it's something very what the Matan Moshe says, something very powerful. Number one, that we have to do, that tshuva is sort of the key that unlocks our ability to do tefillah. So before we get to Rosh Hashanah, before we say the Matan Tokef, we should be process of tshuva. And I also, I also like this idea that in terms of the Bavli, that the Marsha said that that Shinui Masa is like Shinui, Shinui Shem is like Shinui Masa, that that doing tshuva helps us get a new reputation. That's a very good thing. But anyway, so one reason why it might actually make sense that Ganai was the author of this poem, because Unas HaNetokef seems to correspond more with the Rishalmi than it does with the Bavli, right? The language is more serious. Tshuva, tefillah, and tzedaka versus tzedaka, tzedaka, and Shinui Masa. So, and this additional Shinui Shem. So it makes sense. If Yanai lived in Eretz Yisrael, so maybe he followed the Talmud Yerushalmi, and therefore he used the version of the Yerushalmi.
Which note are you referring to?
What do you mean? I was explaining it outside. That wasn't in a particular source, but I was just saying that I think it makes sense that, and Rabbi Kenneth Brander suggests that it might make sense that that Yanai was the author in light of the fact if he used the Yerushalmi, so then the piyud sort of fits the Yerushalmi a little more. We talked about why the order might be a little different. One more aspect relates to the authorship that I think has an important theological implication. So if Yanai was a poet, so how did this legend of Rabbi Amnon come into being, and what does that teach us? So, question that we have to ask in that respect is, what is Unas HaNetokef doing before Kedusha? Does it have anything to do with Kedusha?
It's leading to Kedusha,
but the text, for the most part, doesn't have very much to do with Kedusha. But perhaps, even if Yanai wasn't the author of the poem, perhaps we can suggest that the way that the poem came into popular use, and specifically found its way into Kedusha, has a little bit to do with the story of Rabbi Amnon. Okay, so we look at source 8, the Gemara, famous Gemara, that generally speaking, there's an avera called avera shabatara im omrim ladam avar val tehareg. If somebody comes up to a Jew and says, break Shabbos and I won't kill you, so yaravar v'yal yeharek. Okay, so better to break Shabbos. Better to eat treif than to die, because of the pasuk of Achai Bahem, we're supposed to live by the mitzvos. But there's three exceptions. Chutz me'avodah zarah v'guli arayos v'shvichus damin. Okay, so avodah zarah is an exception, guli arayos v'shvichus damin is an exception. So then Gemara says, avodah zarah lo. Avodah Zarah, you have to die. V'hatanya Amar Rabbi Shmuel, minayin she'im amru lo la'adam avodah Zarah ve'al te'ereg, minayin she'avod ve'al ye'harek. So maybe Avodah Zarah, according to Rabbi Shmuel, is like all the other mitzvot, that if somebody tells you to do it, so just do it and don't die. And based on V'chai Bahem, you should live by them. So then the Gemara says, Yakol afil b'parhesya, perhaps, well, what about in public? That we're not allowed to do avodah zarah. If you had to do avodah zarah in private, maybe that would be different. But in public, so we're not supposed to desecrate Hashem's name. V'nikdashti, now we become sanctified through this act of dying instead of.
What did they say? Yoreh ha'ata don't apply.
What
in private?
So with avodah zarah, according to Rabbi Shmuel, It only applies
in public.
What? It only applies in public.
Private, right?
So, okay, but that's where this idea of Kiddush Hashem comes from, that when we are in a situation where Hashem's name is going to be desecrated, so we're supposed to martyr ourselves on behalf of that. Right, and that comes up especially during the time of Crusades and medieval period. That comes up of these Yeharik Valiyah words. It comes up particularly with Avodah Zarah, with the many attempts to convert Jews. So let's look at what Professor Kimmelman says. So, instead of introducing him, Tanna Tokef serves as a siluk introducing Kedusha, though ostensibly has nothing to do with Kedusha. This liturgical role may be ascribed to the story of the martyrdom of Rav Amnon of Mainz. Okay, then he explains this story in the Zeruah. Since Amnon died for the sake of Kedushat Hashem, the Hebrew term for martyrdom, for his refusal to apostatize and convert to Christianity, Tanna Tokef became associated with the Kedusha and his own martyrdom. Why do we say the Tanna Tokef before Kedusha? So this piyut became popularized during the period of the Crusades when people were dying of Kiddush Hashem. So to the extent that this legend is associated with this piyut, so it made sense to do it before Kedusha because you have Kiddush Hashem, you have the link between Kiddush Hashem and Kedusha, right? And notes in the later in the piyut it says Asei Laman Shemecha Kadesh Shimcha Makdishei Shemecha. So that refers to those who were martyred for Kedushas Hashem. We should do this and sanctify your name for those who sanctified your name. We will sanctify your name as well as those who are martyred for Kedushas Hashem. The request itself is based on a feature and theology of Yechezkel that Hashem must sanctify His name by redeeming Bnei Yisrael, lest His name become tarnished. Okay, but that might be the link between Unsan Tokef and Kedusha. Is this Kiddush Hashem. And so even if Yanai was the poet and it was much earlier, so it could be that the story of Rabbi Amnon and the context in which Unsan Tokef became more popular during this time, so the context of Kedusha actually makes a lot of sense. Rabbi Brander brings another aspect of this Kiddush Hashem. So even if it's not Yanai who wrote the poem, so perhaps Rabbi Amnon represents a community of minds. His name comes from the word emuna. He represented the acts of faith performed by the members of the community of minds, Shvayer, and Worms. People of emuna ascribe the message of Tanna Tokef through the lives that they led. Whether Rabbi Amnon was a single individual or composite of many individuals who sacrificed their lives, it is he or they who wrote the prayer through their actions. Perhaps this is what being related when the Orzarua sources the story of Unatan Tokef. For he uses the following language, the Rabbi Amnon instituted Unatan Tokef. He never mentions that he actually composed it, but that he instituted it. Okay, so the idea was that Rabbi Amnon is a pillar of Emuna, and the way that this piyut became popularized, even though it was written earlier, but as people didn't know from year to year who's going to die through the sword and who's going to die by fire and conditions were very turbulent. So people live their lives through Emuna, through Kiddush Hashem, through showing their faith in God, and Rabbi Amnon and Unatan Tokef sort of represents that. In the next source, I brought an individual, Rabbi Penny Dunner, who I do a Yarchei Kalah with. He wrote an essay on the legend of Rabbi Amnon. So I'm not going to read this inside, but he just notes that actually the story of Rabbi Amnon has a lot of resemblance to a lot of other legends that were popular in Germany at the time. So the story of Rabbi Amnon contextually makes sense there. He says, it was also recorded for posterity at a time when German Jewry was reeling from Crusader atrocities against Jews. What it's certain is that it had nothing whatsoever to do with the composition of Tanna Tokef, based on the fact that it was found in the Kairo Geniza, in a fragment that already predates Rabbi Amnon. Just a basic summary. So it seems like starting point is that that Unatan Tokef was found as a fragment in the Kairo Geniza, and the fragment can be dated before the story of Rabbi Amnon could have taken place. But nonetheless, the popularization of the piyun might have to do with whether or not there was even a Rabbi Amnon or not. But Rabbi Amnon might stand for what was happening during the time period in which this piyut became popularized, and that's why it appears in Kedusha, because of the link with Kedusha Hashem. So, just want to end with this paragraph on the Tshuva Tefillah and Staka from Professor Kimmelman that I think is just it's a very nice way to end, since we discussed it before. What then is the relationship among the three that is relevant to the thesis Unatana Tokev? Tshuva starts with our relationship with the self, Tefillah addresses our relationship with God, and Staka works on our relationship with others. The focus moves inward, upward, and outward, for Tshuva is inner-directed, Tefillah is God-directed, and Staka is other-directed. Okay, so yeah, those categories of Binanam Chaveru, Binanam Lamakam, Binanam La'atzmo. Okay, the first involves the mind, the second the tongue, the third the hand, thereby advancing the thought to word to deed. Tshuva means we care enough about ourselves to strive to our ideal self. Tefillah means that we care enough about God to make ourselves worthy of His concern and assessment. And Staka means we care enough about others to help them in their need. In turning to others, God turns to us. Putting ourselves in order, repairing our relationship with God, and working on improving our relationship with others help overcome our isolation, cushioning the impact. By enhancing our capacity to withstand the vicissitudes of life, we are able to muster the fortitude to believe that this too will pass. So as we come closer to Rosh Hashanah, we say Unisana and Tokev. Okay, so I think the authorship stuff is interesting history, but I think there's very powerful ideas that we've mentioned about Tshuva and Tefillah and Staka and Kiddush Hashem, but ultimately, understanding this piyut hopefully gives us the power to think about the importance of doing the tshuva with the relationship with ourselves, the tefillah, our relationship with God, and stuck on terms of the way we relate to everyone. So I want to see the